He paused at the corner of the table and surveyed the line of ivory balls. His single eye had a predatory gleam to it, tawny yellow and strangely flecked, like the eye of an eagle. The empty socket of the other eye was covered with a black cloth patch, and it gave him the air of a genteel pirate as he smiled across the table at his opponent. "Cannon and losing hazard off red," Mungo St. John announced calmly, and there was a roar of comment in which a dozen voices were offering odds of 5-1 and better against the play. And Harry Mellow grinned boyishly and tipped his head in reluctant admiration of the big man's audacity. The game they were playing was Zambezi nominated three cushion, which is as far from ordinary billiards as the little gecko lizards on the barroom rafters were from the big gnarled 20-foot mugger crocodiles of the Zambezi pools. It was a local variation of the game, combining the most difficult elements of English and French billiards. The player's cue ball had to strike three cushions of the table before completing a scoring coup. But in addition to this monstrous condition, the player had to announce beforehand exactly how he intended scoring. This prevented him executing a fluke score, and if he did make an unannounced and therefore unintended winning stroke, he was penalised the points he should have won. It was a tough game. The stakes between the players were £5 a point, but naturally the players and the spectators were free to offer side bets for or against the players making their nominated coup. With players of the calibre of Harry Mellow and Mungo St. John on the table, there was £1,000 or more riding on each stroke, and the voices that shouted the odds, and those that accepted them, were hoarse with tension. Mungo St. John replaced the long black cheroot between his teeth, and he made a little tripod with the fingers of his left hand. Then he laid the polished maplewood cue into the notch of his thumb and forefinger. There was a final flurry of bets, and then a silence fell over the crowded room. The air was blue with tobacco smoke, and the faces that strained forward were flushed and sweating. Mungo St. John lined up his white cue ball with his single bright eye, and across the table Harry Mellow took a slow breath and held it. If Mungo succeeded with the cannon, it scored 2 points, and another 3 points for the hazard off red. But that was not all that was at stake, for Harry had placed a side bet of £50 against the score. He stood to lose or win over 100 guineas. Mungo St. John's face was grave as a professor of philosophy considering the riddle of the universe as he made a gentle practice stroke that he arrested with the leather button at the tip of the long cue almost touching the white ivory ball. Then he drew back the cue deliberately to its full travel. At the instant that he launched the stroke, the voice of a young woman cut through the bated silence of watching men. "General St. John, you must come quickly." There were only 100 white women in the entire vast land north of the Shashi and south of the Zambezi rivers, of which probably 90 were already married, and most of the others spoken for. A voice with such lovely ringing tones could have turned every male head down both sides of the Champs-Élysées. But in the billiard saloon of the Grand Hotel of women-starved Bulawayo, it had the effect of a close-range broadside of grapeshot. A waiter dropped a tray laden with schooners of beer. A heavy wooden bench toppled over backwards with a shattering crash as the 6 men seated upon it sprang to attention like guardsmen. An inebriated transport rider toppled backwards off the counter on top of the barman, who instinctively swung a round-arm punch at him, missed, and swept a row of whiskey bottles off the shelf. The sudden uproar in the deep silence would have unnerved a marble statue of Zeus. But Mungo St. John completed his stroke with an almost creamy smoothness, his single yellow eye unblinking in the calm, handsome face as it followed the flight of the ball from the tip of his cue. The white ball thumbed crisply against the far cushion, doubled the table, and the spin hooked it through the corner, striking the cushion at an angle that bled the speed off the ivory. It came trundling back, and Mungo St. John lifted his left hand to let it pass under his nose. It touched the other white ball with just sufficient force to deflect it a hair's breadth and send it on to kiss the red ball like a lover. The contact robbed the cue ball of the last of its impetus, and it hovered on the edge of the corner pocket for a weary moment and then dropped soundlessly into the net. It was a perfect cannon and losing hazard, nominated and executed, and £1,000 had been won and lost in those few seconds. But every man in the room except Mungo St. John was staring at the doorway in a kind of mesmeric trance. Mungo St. John lifted his cue ball from the net and re-spotted it. Then, as he chalked his cue again, he murmured, "Victoria, my dear, there are times when even the prettiest young lady should remain silent." Once again, he stooped over the table. "Pot red," he announced, and the company was so entranced by the tall, coppery-haired girl in their midst that no bet was offered nor accepted. But as Mungo St. John took his cue back for the next stroke, Victoria spoke again. "General St. John, my mother is dying." But this time, Mungo St. John's head flew up, his single eye wide with shock, and the white ball screwed off down the table in a violent miscue as he stared at Vicky. Mungo let the wooden cue drop with a clatter onto the floor, and he ran from the barroom. Vicky went on standing in the doorway of the barroom for a few seconds. Her hair was tangled into thick ropes on her shoulders by the wind, and her breathing was still so rough that her breasts heaved tantalizingly under her thin cotton blouse. Her eyes swept the sea of grinning, ingratiating faces, and then stopped when they reached the tall figure of Harry Mellow, in his dark riding boots and breeches, and the faded blue shirt open at his throat to show a nest of crisp curls in the V. Vicky flushed and turned to hurry back through the doorway. Harry Mellow tossed his cue to the barman and shoved his way through the disappointed crowd. By the time he reached the street, Mungo St. John, still bareheaded and in shirt sleeves, was mounted on a big bay mare, but leaning from the saddle to talk urgently to Vicky, who stood at his stirrup. Mungo looked up and saw Harry. "Mr. Mellow," he called, "I would be obliged if you could see my stepdaughter safely out of town. I am needed at Carmi." Then he put his heels into the mare's flanks, and she jumped away at a dead run down the dusty street. Vicky was climbing up onto the driving seat of a rickety little cart drawn by two diminutive donkeys with drooping, melancholy ears, and on the seat beside her sat the mountainous black figure of a Matabele woman. "Miss Codrington," Harry called urgently, "please wait." He reached the wheel of the cart with a few long strides and looked up at Vicky. "I have wanted to see you again so very much." "Mr. Mellow," Vicky lifted her chin haughtily, "the road to Carmi Mission is clearly signposted. You could not possibly have lost your way." "Your mother ordered me off the mission station. You know that damned well."
"Please do not use strong language in my presence, sir," said Vicky primly.
"I apologize, but your mother does have a reputation. They say she fired both barrels at one unwanted visitor."
"Well," Vicky admitted, "that is true. But he was one of Mr. Rhodes's hirelings, and it was birdshot, and she did miss with one barrel."
"Well, I am one of Mr. Rhodes's hirelings, and she might have upped to buckshot, and the practice might have improved her shooting."
"I like a man of determination, a man who takes what he wants, and damn the consequences."
"That is strong language, Miss Codrington."
"Good day to you, Mr. Mellow."
Vicky shook up the donkeys, and they stumbled into a dejected trot. The little cart reached the outskirts of the new town, where the dozen or so brick buildings gave way to grass huts and tattered, dusty canvas shelters, and where the wagons of the transport riders were parked wheel to wheel on both sides of the track, still laden with the bags, bolts, and bales that they had carried up from the railhead. Vicky was sitting upright on the cart, looking straight ahead, but anxiously she told Juba out of the side of her mouth,
"Tell me if you see him coming, but don't let him see you looking."
"He comes," Juba announced comfortably. "He comes like a cheetah after a gazelle." Vicky heard the beat of galloping hooves from behind, but she merely sat up a little straighter.
"How?" Juba smiled with nostalgic sadness. The passion of a man. My husband ran 50 miles without stopping to rest or drink, for in those days my beauty drove men mad. Don't stare at him, Juba. Oh, he is so strong and impetuous, and he will make such fine sons in your belly. Juba, Vicky flushed scarlet, that's a wicked thing for a Christian lady even to think. I shall probably send him back anyway. Juba shrugged and chuckled. Ah, then he will make those fine sons elsewhere. I saw him looking at Elizabeth when he came to Kami. Vicky's blushes turned a deeper, angrier shade. You are an evil woman, Juba. But before she could go on, Harry Mellow reined in his rangy gelding beside the cart. Your stepfather placed you in my care, Miss Codrington, and it is therefore my duty to see you home as swiftly as possible. He reached into the cart, and before she realized his intentions, he had whipped a long, sinewy arm around her waist, and as she kicked and shrieked with surprise, he swung her up onto the horse's rump behind his saddle. Hold on, he ordered, tightly. And instinctively, she threw both arms around his lean, hard body. The way it felt shocked her so that she relaxed her grip and leaned back just as Harry urged the gelding forward, and Vicky came so perilously close to flying backwards over his haunches into the dusty track that she snatched at Harry with renewed fervour and tried to close her mind and shut off her body from these unfamiliar sensations. Her training warned her that anything that raised such a warmth in the base of her stomach made the skin of her forearms prickle so and rendered her breathless and deliriously light-headed must be unholy and wicked. To distract herself, she examined the fine hairs that grew down the back of his neck and the soft, silky skin behind his ears, and found yet another sensation rising in her throat, a kind of choking, suffocating tenderness. She had an almost unbearable compulsion to press her face against the faded blue shirt and breathe in the virile smell of his body. It had the sharp odour of steel struck against flint, underlaid with a warmer scent like the first raindrops on sun-baked earth. Her confusion was dispelled abruptly by the realization that the gelding was still in a flying gallop, and at this pace the journey back to Kami would be brief indeed. "You are punishing your mount, sir," her voice quavered and played her false, so Harry turned his head. "I cannot hear you." She leaned unnecessarily close, so that her loose hair touched his cheek and her lips brushed his ear. "Not so fast," she repeated. "Your mother is not that ill. But you told General St. John. Do you think Juba and I would have left Kami if there was the least danger?" "St. John? It was a fine excuse to get them together again. So romantic, we should allow them a little time alone." Harry reined the gelding down to a more sedate pace, but instead of relaxing her grip, Vicky wriggled a little closer. "My mother does not recognize her own feelings," she explained. "Sometimes Lizzie and I have to take things into our own hands." Even as she said it, Vicky regretted having mentioned her twin's name. She had also noticed Harry Mellow looking at Elizabeth on his only visit to Kami Mission, and she had seen Elizabeth look straight back. After Harry had left Kami in some haste, with her mother's ultimate farewells ringing in his ears, Vicky had attempted to negotiate with her sister an agreement that Elizabeth would not encourage further smouldering glances from Mr. Mellow. In reply, Elizabeth had smiled in that infuriating way she had. "Don't you think we should let Mr. Mellow decide on that?"